Luckily for you, the answer to the great question of life, the universe and everything is to be found in this podcast, A Worker's Guide to Everything. Sometimes cans, often bad language, always solid politics. This is the Trademark Belfast podcast. Listen out for Trademark regulars and very special comrade guests and fellow travellers talking all things lefty, Ireland and the world. We remain, as always, anti-sectarian, anti-racist and anti-fascist. Enjoy. Buenas tardes.
Sorry for sounding a bit late. Some people had to go to the bar. I don't know who would do that at a political meeting, but it's outrageous. Thank you all so much for being here tonight. My name is Maeve McDade and I'm a researcher and I live in this very fine city. And I think that every political meeting this weekend should start with a big cheer for the Liverpool Dockers. So let's hear for them. Well, we're actually delighted. We planned this meeting before the census results came out this week. And for those of you who don't know, for the first time in 100 years since the creation of the statelet that is called Northern Ireland, the census has showed us that Catholics now outnumber Protestants. And the reason that's important is because the state was created in order to preserve a Protestant majority, to be a Protestant state for a Protestant people, which by its own reckoning was a state rooted in discrimination and oppression. So what the census data can't tell us an awful lot about the future of Ireland. We're hoping that the three people on the panel here will be able to tell us what they could make of it, or more generally, what I posed to them was, Chucky Arla, has our day come? I say Chucky Arla a lot, but I meant it this time. I said, has our day come? Has it come? So that's what we're going to talk about tonight. And perhaps unsurprisingly, there was a bit of a silence on the British left. I think if there had been a census similar in France, we would have had some hot takes, but there was a notable silence, which is a shame, but that's part of the reason that we're here today, because we're really committed to building that political education on the British left. But we are competing with McLunch. We almost lost Claire Daly. She wanted to go to the McLunch talk, but we convinced her to stay and talk to us instead. But I've also no doubt that somebody in the RMT is out there shouting Chucky Arla as well. So, solidarity to them. This event was made possible with the support of Trademark. Trademark is the anti-sectarian unit of the British left.
And
Oh, God, what did I say? Oh, so embarrassing. I officially retire from public speaking now. But we do work in Britain. Fuck's sake. Can I recover from this?
No, that's it. You got it.
Anyway, our first speaker is Stevie. Thanks, Stevie.
Okay, thank you.
Stevie has been a lead in kind of building that political education, but also giving people the tools that kind of to radically change the way in which we organise, both in our workplaces and our trade unions, but across Ireland and across Britain too. We will also have the fabulous Claire Daly. Claire is an MEP for Dublin constituency. She's part of the left in the European Parliament, but don't blame her for that, she says. Claire was jailed in 2003 for protesting with the anti-bin tax campaign and was a local organiser in the Right to Water campaign. And maybe some of you were at the Right to Water campaign earlier. We've also got Dave. Big round of applause for that historic campaign. And then finally, we'll have Chris Hazard, the abstentionist MP for Sinn Féin. He was a former MLA minister in the Stormont Executive. Don't blame him for that. And Chris is South Down's first ever Republican MP when he was elected in 2017. But over to Stevie. Stevie, Chucky Arla.
Thank you very much. I'm just going to shout. Is that okay? I don't want to use the mic. Is that okay? Can everyone hear me? Is that fine? Yes, I don't need a mic. There you go. Thanks very much. So thank you very much, Maeve, Dr. McDay, excuse me, for organising this and for putting the wee panel together. It's a pleasure, of course, to be on a panel with two great politicians, two great parliamentarians. Also handy for me, of course, because they kind of bookend my contribution. Because both of them are elected to parliaments, so I don't think Ireland should have anything to do with it. Neither the British one nor indeed the European one. And for very similar reasons, that they're both irreformable, anti-democratic monstrosities. And, that was going to get a round of applause, I just threw it in there. Anyway, but the best we can hope for is a disappearance of both of those. The Parliament's not my two comrades. Not since the IRA attacks in London in the 90s, I think you can all agree, as the Irish question so-called moved so quickly from like, the periphery of British politics to the middle of it, and not because the British state wanted it, because Brexit actually demanded it. We've not been close, as some have suggested, to United Ireland since partition. There's no doubt this is kind of a watershed moment in British-Irish relations this century, and we're going to see massive changes over the next 5 to 10 years. After the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, the North went into a kind of quiet stasis for about 20 years. We called it at home kind of a negative peace. Kind of live there, live separately, shut up. But most people nonetheless welcomed that transition from conflict to relative peace. What was less welcome, I think, was the framing of the peace agreement as some sort of tribal warfare between the orange and the green, and the British state managed to position itself as some sort of neutral arbitrator, as opposed to being a direct participant in the conflict and indeed a driver of the conflict. It also allowed as well that framing for deeper structural issues to go unaddressed, and it kind of paved the way for another transition, which we call the double transition. You had that transition from conflict to peace, welcome, but also a really unwelcome transition from, broadly speaking, the end of military Keynesianism, if you want to call it that, to a fully neoliberal regime in the six counties. Not just the British subvention being reduced year on year, but also the introduction of the lunacy of public-private partnerships, the institutional obsession with foreign direct investment and capital flows, property speculation on a massive scale, new hotels, new student accommodation, new grade A office space, really just a rentier capitalist kind of model for the North, sucking out whatever little wealth the North might be able to create for itself. Leaving, of course, in its wake, degraded public services, rising inequality, a suicide epidemic, and shit service jobs, non-unionised for the most part. I mean, it should be clear to anyone the eyes to see that the North just isn't a sustainable economic, political or cultural entity. The question for us is its time up? And what will the transition like to a new Ireland look like, if and when it happens? I mean, there's no doubt that the relationship between the six counties and Britain has also changed in that period. You could argue back in the 40s and 50s that the North held some sort of, I don't know, the Brits looked at it as a kind of strategic imperial asset, you know, they needed it. I think during the peace process, that moves to a kind of position of studied neutrality, to one now, I think, where the parts of the British establishment, at least, I don't know how much of it, but part of it, looks upon the North as a burden or an inconvenience. I think Dominic Cummings summed it up brilliantly 2 years ago when he said he couldn't care less if Northern Ireland falls into the fucking sea. And yet, even as that relationship was changing over the last 20 years, we kind of thought, the people living and working there, that only an external shock from the outside would really break the status quo and force the issue. We'd taken it as far as we could take it. And of course, that shock came with Brexit. It's one of the reasons why I voted for it. Not for the legs arguments that you use here in Britain, because that's a British concern, but for what it meant in Ireland. Because what it meant in Ireland was, if the Britain leaves the EU, then the British border in Ireland might have to go with it. And so a border poll on Irish unity, use the words of Alex Kane, who's a well-known unionist commentator in the North, has moved from kind of possible to likely to certain. And whilst there's a vague mechanism, a really shit mechanism in the Good Friday Agreement for calling a border poll, it's not in our gift, it's in the gift of the British state and the Secretary, there's no sure route to uniting its people, and there's no sure route to uniting its working class, and that's a major issue for us on the left. Not least because there are quite a few hundred thousand people in the northeast corner who might not be too keen on the idea yet. And alongside that changing nature of the relationship between the six counties and Britain, there's also internal dynamics that have shifted dramatically. The DUP, of course, is a symbol of that change, and I explain why. The DUP is my mate Billy Mitchell, former member of the PUP and UVF, described them as Ulster's answer to the Taliban. I mean, they've spent the last 4 years alienating huge swathes of the population, not just here, but also in the North, not just the nationalist community, but also within the unionist community, particularly not just around like, language rights and cultural expression, but also blocking access to abortion, blocking access to LGBT rights. The kind of, the DUP and whatever you've got going over here, I don't know what to call it, English fucking disaster nationalism, I don't know what you're gonna call it, they're kind of the gifts that keep on giving for Irish unity. I mean, watching the DUP, like a party that just revels in punching itself in the face continually. I mean, personally, I love it. It's a fucking marvellous thing to watch all the time. In regards to Brexit, I can't remember his name, an English journalist said that the DUP chased Brexit like a dog chasing a car, and when they got it, they didn't know what to do with it. But if chasing the hardest of hard Brexit meant supporting Tory policies, it was directly damaged and attacked their own working class communities, all working class communities, all damaged the northern economy, then that was the price that the DUP were willing for the rest of us to pay. But then the slow realisation kicks in, of course. Oh, fuck, we fucked up. This means a border in the Irish Sea. And all of those brilliant strategic moves by the DUP have political consequences. And at the last election in the North, more unionists didn't vote for the DUP than did vote for the DUP. And that's a significant shift. Now, that might change at the next election momentarily, but the bigger picture is the growth of a, I suppose you'd call it more of a civic unionism rather than ethnic unionism. You know, less God and Ulster, more kind of, I don't know, tea and crumpets with the Alliance Party, you know, the socially liberal, fiscally conservative Alliance Party. But the big story here is that traditional big house unionism, that political tradition in the North that held together the North by providing cross-class unity between the wealthy and the working class loyalists, it's broken, it's gone, and it won't be back. And increasingly, unionist middle classes and the business community, they are not being served by the leaders of political unionism. And that's hugely significant in terms of the internal dynamics of the North. And so unification, for some in that camp, is not the leap it was even 5 years ago. And again, that's a significant change. For others, the census results, as May referred to on Thursday, provide some hope. I don't think any of us are stupid enough or naive enough to think that a Catholic nationalist majority will equally transfer directly into some sort of majority yes vote in a referendum. I don't think any of us are that naive. But that's not to say that it's not a historic change, it's not a historic demographic shift. My hunch is that Stormont will return after another election. Devolution will trundle on until the next crisis, till it comes down again. And whilst there is growing frustration with the dysfunction of the six counties and the dysfunction of the politics there, I think people will give devolution another little go yet. And that might mean another 1, 2, or 3 cycles of power sharing. And that might be 4, 8, or 12 years, who knows, before they opt for the nuclear button, which is the poll and new constitutional arrangements in Ireland. Having said all that, it's probably worth noting at this point that if there's a Scottish referendum on Scottish independence in the next 2 years, that will have a massive domino effect on Ireland and will accelerate the drive towards unification in Ireland. So that will be interesting to keep our eye on. There are dangers too in all of this, not least the loyalist working class, and not the danger of violence, by the way, which is what everyone thought of immediately when I said the loyalist working class. Not this imaginary violent gene that English liberals love to think dictates the behaviour of everyone on that fucking island, as if British state violence wasn't actually the real problem there. But rather, the whole sections of the working class might be left out of this debate, with no inclusion, no voice. That's my real fear, because the loyalist working class are my working class, and they need to be involved in this debate as well. And as a result, there's a danger that they might become more retrenched, more reactionary, more withdrawn, looking not forward, but looking permanently backwards. And in that regard, there's serious work to be done, and none of it's being done, and no one's doing it. And there's huge issues there. We can have a debate about leadership from within working class loyalism and so on. I was at a meeting in the Bogside about 20 years ago, and this is a story about why it's important that that work's done, because a referendum on its own simply isn't enough to change Ireland. And we were with representatives of the Provisional Movement and the UVF, and we were talking about United Ireland. We were talking about the demographic shift. This was 20 years ago, and the Provisional lad, nearly said his name there, community worker, and the UVF boy was a community worker, right? And we were talking about demographic shifts and changes in the future of Ireland. And the Provisional lad said to UVF, he goes, what are you going to do when there's more Catholics in this place than Protestants, when there's more Nationalists than Unionists? What are you going to do when we get 50% plus one? And the UVF boy just looked up and says, well, we'll just shoot one of you. Now, yeah, we laughed nervously at the time. But it spoke to a very real challenge, that 50% plus one in a referendum is a legitimate polling result, but it isn't enough to create a new Ireland. It's not enough. Unification on its own isn't enough. The voice of the working class needs to be involved in the negotiations about any changes, any constitutional changes, and I'm not convinced that's going to be the case. That's my real fear. And that it will simply be a process dominated by the voices of capital, of vulture funds, of the banking industry, of the City of London, of the Irish Financial Services Centre, of the Irish comprador class, that they'll make all of the decisions about what kind of new Ireland emerges. I remember Patrick Hobine, the lad that left the Shinner because he's against women's rights and abortion rights, he said that United Ireland would be brilliant. He said it'd be like a TTIP for Ireland. I mean, that was the view, that this will release massive waves of capital flows and capital investment. And it's important that the working class are involved in this because the capitalist class are already having this conversation. I know that Claire's going to talk about this afterwards. What's also clear, and I'll finish on this point, is that, and it's a longer, deeper, more complex conversation, is that the political class and the business class, if that was a Venn diagram, it might just be a circle, mightn't it? That they are, or they've kind of decided that the European Union is going to be the political vehicle for unification. And that's a problem. It's a major problem for me and for others on the left. We used to argue years ago, didn't we? We used to argue for a 32-county socialist republic. That was done. We also argued for a united, independent, and sovereign Ireland. That Ireland should be a sovereign state, free of the interference of the British Empire. And as much as Connolly might have said that Britain had no right in Ireland, I'm thinking he might have had something to say about the European Union as well. I mean, we can rightly talk about the EU's and neoliberalism's assault against sovereignty, their war against sovereignty. And by that I mean the express will of the people, an old school Republican principle called democracy. Because central to the EU project, central to neoliberalism project globally, is the insulation or the kind of protection of neoliberalism, the protection of the free market from democratic challenge and democratic change. You'll remember Michel Barnier's quote after the Greek vote, there is no democratic choice against the European treaties. And so what is the function of a united Ireland inside the European Union? Is it just to police the working class, to ensure there's no interference in the massive transfer of wealth from labour to capital that has been, that globalisation has overseen for the last 30 or 40 years? So we potentially kind of place ourselves in a neoliberal straitjacket at the time when we need to be free to create a new Ireland, and to an island that we design. And we kind of create these self-imposed external constraints that prevent us from doing that. 10 years ago, 2012 was it? We ratified, or the Republic ratified, the Fiscal Compact Treaty. Just one example, the 30th Amendment to the Irish Constitution. Did we ratify a right to a house, right to a job, right to water? No. We ratified German budgetary discipline, debt to GDP ratios, fiscal rules in our fucking constitution. The thing we have to remember is that that direction of travel, that permanent austerity, is written into those treaties, and we haven't now written into our constitution. So as part of a new Ireland that we were negotiating, we wanted to, have a green industrial revolution, a green new deal. If you want to move away from fossil fuels, wind, wave, solar power, if you want to give every worker a job guarantee, give every worker a house, transform our food production, rewild our mountains, protect our fishing stocks, our fishing communities, the rules-based order say, no, you can't do that. But feel free to go to the private sector and ask them to do that for you. Feel free to sell every asset this state has to the vultures in the market, because that's the direction of travel of this free market club that we're moving into, out of one frying pan, straight into a fire. And meanwhile, the left across Europe, and you'll know this, cling to those institutions in a vain belief that somehow they're going to reform them, despite all of the evidence to the contrary. I mean, if there's any country in Europe that can make a case for progressive, socialist, national sovereignty, it's Ireland. National self-determination, national sovereignty are not reactionary concepts. I mean, a vast history of left-wing liberation movements attest to that fact, including our own, by the way. If we're serious about meeting the challenges of a new Ireland, whatever it might look like, wherever it might emerge, and meeting the multiple crises of capitalism and climate breakdown, then we need to be in a position to be able to offer a radical, transformative programme. One based, yes, on internationalism, but also on economic democracy, on public ownership, on full employment, on a massive transfer of wealth and assets from rich to poor. Interdependent but independent nations where the voice of the people actually fucking matters, where ownership is ours collectively. The big question is, and I'll finish on this point, is where is the broad-based left-wing and democratic forces that would deliver that, that would challenge those rules, that would ignore those rules, that would break those rules? Because without that, you might get a united Ireland, we might get a unified Ireland at some point, but it won't be a new Ireland. In the words of James Connolly, it will just be old wine in new bottles. That's me, Gora Maigi. Thanks.
Right, okay, I might as well use the mic to justify the expenditure. Look, and I know I see a lot of faces that we saw many hours ago at the meeting that Stevie and Dave did, and you've had a long day, and Stevie's a hard act to follow, but I suppose it's a very great privilege for me to be here. I have to say I was amused when I saw the publication of the census figures coming out during the week, which shows that for the first time now, it was always going to happen. The Catholics have outbred the Protestants, are now in a majority. But what it actually means is that the discussion that we're having here today is one which has been had in the pages of the mainstream media over the past few days. Chucky or law, has Ireland's day come? Is the prospect of a united Ireland now on the cards? And obviously the census is one factor. To be honest about it, I don't think it's the reason at all. It is a factor, but it's not actually even the main one. Stevie referred earlier, and you probably don't know, but this day next week we have a major event in Dublin. Some of you may have been at concerts before in the Three Arena. It's the major venue in Dublin. It's absolutely huge. And we have this gathering for Ireland's future, Together We Can. It's a sort of a Barack Obama type slogan. And the glossy posters for it feature pictures of all the great and the good in Ireland, a lovely picture of everybody in it. And you have assembled in that gathering, you have the leaders of the Irish Business Federation, small businesses, you have members, MPs from Britain, MLAs from Northern Ireland, you have Fianna Fáil members, you have the most reactionary Fine Gaeler in the Parliament in Ireland, and then you have Leo Varadkar also, who's not even the most reactionary. You have Sinn Féin, People Before Profit, the Labour Party, Padraig Tobin, Stevie's friend, are all coming together under that remit. So why is this going on? How are all these people come into a room to discuss the topic that we're kind of discussing now? The reason for that to me is that the establishment see that this is coming and they want to make absolutely sure to hijack it and make sure that it is a capitalist United Ireland where the interests of big business are sort of marshalled and policed, and that's why they're gathering that together. But on the other side, it does mean that a momentum is developing behind this idea, and it's interesting to see that some of the unions have signed up to that. Sadly, not the most radical of unions. We see some of the more conservative unions are buying tickets and issuing tickets to all their members to come. So it's becoming very mainstream and respectable now to talk about Chucky or Law. So for me, I think one of the ironies is that one of the reasons why this issue is posed now actually is, as Stevie has said, Brexit. We all know that a majority of people in Northern Ireland voted against Brexit. And to overcome that, the idea of United Ireland is a handy kind of way out. I mean, if you were a middle-class Protestant who never really thought about this and are not very political, but you'd like to go on seamless travel to Europe and you'd like your children to be educated in Europe and all that sort of stuff, sure, look, why not? A way to have a United Ireland would be a way out of that. I mean, clearly the exit from the single market is an issue for a section of the business class on both sides of the border, because despite and even with the protocol, Brexit is a headache. It's a long-term headache for the South membership of the single market. And in that sense, it's in the strategic interest now of the Irish business class to look at the idea of a United Ireland. And we have to be careful in that, because their interests and ours are conflicting. And what they see out of this is the prospect now of, I suppose, prostituting not just a 26-county tax haven Irish Republic, but a 32-county United Ireland, around which there'd be huge sort of, you know, international momentum behind it. All the diaspora in America will get behind it. They see ka-ching, ka-ching, the opportunity to come in there. So I think that is an important backdrop. And it explains one of the ironies, I suppose, that one of the momentums behind the drive for United Ireland is Brexit. So Ireland's drive for our independence from Britain is spurred on by our desire to remain in the European Union, which, as Stevie says, is not a union of equals, as they always tell us, or a bastion of values and all the rest of it. But it is a neoliberal club in the interests of big business. I mean, another major reason, obviously, for the momentum is the rise of Sinn Féin, and I'm not going to steal Chris's thunder on that, but obviously Sinn Féin on both sides of the border, largest party in the north, most popular in the south, have enough seats now to keep the right wing from forming forcing Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens together, and in fairness, bringing about the possibility of a left-right divide in the south for the first time ever. And I think the prospect of Sinn Féin being in government north and south does bring the possibility of a border poll very much nearer. For me, being in the south and maybe a little bit out of that, I am obviously in the Brussels bubble at the moment, but I'm not so sure that a border poll at the moment would necessarily pass. Maybe there will be a slight majority in the north. I don't know. A lot of people would probably think in the north, do we want to be in the basket case of the southern economy or health service executive versus the NHS, etc.? I know you might think you have problems with the NHS, but trust me, the HSE is way worse. But and in the south, I think as well, it really would depend. If the establishment got behind it and their media mouthpieces, you could see a drive behind it. If they stood against it, then sort of warned about the economic strain, it may be different. But I suppose one of the interesting points is I think that, you know, Sinn Féin's success, while it might bring about a border poll, isn't because of its call for a border poll or support for United Ireland. I mean, the reason for Sinn Féin's success is its socio-economic programme. If you look at their campaign material and so on, they don't focus on the constitutional question, and rightly so. They focus on the real day-to-day issues which are crucifying people north and south of the border. And those are the issues that people want an answer to: the horrible housing crisis in Ireland, the basket case that is our health service, all of those issues people want an answer. The ridiculous situation now in the response to the war in terms of the short-sightedness, the energy crisis, food insecurity, and so on. Actually, the backdrop to this situation is straight out of James Connolly's prophecy, that if you remove the English army tomorrow and hoist the green flag over Dublin Castle, unless you set about the organisation of the Socialist Republic, your efforts will be in vain. England will still rule you through her capitalists, through her landlords, her financiers, through the whole array of commercial individuals that she has planted in that country. But of course now it's not just English capitalism, probably a minor part in the equation since James Connolly's day. Now we have, of course, US capitalism that Irish capitalism has prostrated itself to. We have the vulture funds, which have dominated the rental market and are the key contributor to the appalling housing crisis. 10,000 homeless, the right to have a roof over your head disappearing for so many people. Astronomical rents now and a huge shortage of housing. We have our economy prostrated at the feet of multinationals, of course, that is well known, although they don't admit it. Ireland is a tax haven. Tax avoidance in Ireland is more than all of the Caribbean countries put together. We have the fourth largest shadow banking system globally. And of course, we ignore our policy on neutrality and give over our civilian airport to the US military every single day of the week to use their aircraft on their way to theatres of war in the Middle East and so on. And that isn't bad enough that they want to sell us out to US capitalism. They want to, as Stevie says, bend the knee to the European Union, and they want to be the best little Europeans in class. I don't know if people follow intensely, but we had the most appalling speech by Micheál Martin, our Taoiseach, at the UN the other night, where he called Russia a rogue state, where he called for Russia to lose its seat on the Security Council. Gestures that he's never made about the United States in relation to Afghanistan, Iraq. He's never made about England or the UK or about France in terms of Yemen, Syria, or any of these situations. He has been silent with regard to those. So what they want to do is curry favour with their European masters, play the NATO game. Neutral Ireland has even funded NATO over the past period. I mean, how utterly mad and barbaric is that? So that's the agenda behind this. And so here, if you like, is the contradiction. If Sinn Féin is handed the mandate they're being given is for socio-economic reasons, to have social justice on the island of Ireland. But at the same time, it's posed now, the holy grail, obviously, of unification, which ironically, in part, has been driven by Brexit and the desire for EU membership. And that's a contradiction. Let's say nothing in Ireland is ever simple, because these two processes can't live together. They both can't coincide. One has to give way to the other. So for me, the key issue here really isn't if or when, because that's guaranteed. When, who cares? It's only a matter of time and probably a lot less time. But what sort of Ireland are we building? And in that sense, you know, our day may come, but this is the day we thought that it would be. Adding together the two halves is not going to be the transformative desire that people want. We could have a situation which we saw in a reunified Germany, where we saw really that Germany's capitalist class were able to arbitrage the situation for their own benefit, and the working class on both sides of Germany lost out. Is that what we want? Clearly not. Do we want a 32-county neoliberal imperialist EU statelet, probably part of NATO? Clearly that's not what people want either. But they're the kind of dynamics out of the process that the establishment in Ireland are preparing against the backdrop of this unstoppable momentum now to have some sort of a unification on the island. And I think, and I'd echo Stevie's points in that, the decisive thing here is to have the working class voice cemented onto that situation. Because I know Stevie was very critical of the EU, and he's 100% correct. But the gas thing is that throughout Europe, people are disconnected from the EU as much as we are. And Ireland actually has a unique role to play in that. And we've made that point. We are a neutral country in the heart of Europe, very much in the western part of Europe, but uniquely with the colonial history. We've been colonized. So we can understand maybe some of the fears in Eastern Europe and so on, and we can bridge that gap. But have we done that? No, we haven't. We've absolutely blown it in order to be the best Europeans in class. But that isn't the voice of the people of Ireland. That's the voice of our establishment. And I think we need to intervene into that debate around those type of ideas now. That a united Ireland, which encompasses the internationalism of James Connolly, there's not a contradiction between bringing together a nation state and fighting for internationalism. They actually go hand in hand. It should be part of a campaign against NATO, a campaign against imperialism, standing for our neutrality. It does mean speaking out against the US using our military bases. It means speaking out against global capitalism, where the resources are used to enrich the minority, against the growth economy for women's rights, gay rights, against the narrow-minded church-dominated Ireland, let's face it, that has existed on both sides of the border. So when we talk about a new Ireland, and it is coming, let's get on the page and energise people around that. And part of that is very much anti-war, anti-neoliberalism and internationalism, which is why it's absolutely brilliant to be in England discussing this topic. And thanks very much for having us.
I'm tempted to say we're not in England, we're in Liverpool, but thanks very much to Maeve, Stevie, Trademark and Claire. It's been great listening. I'm also tempted to say I agree with everything nearly has been said, so we'll not go, but we'll give it a go. Look, it seems a lifetime ago now, but this time last year, the rotten legacy of partition was brought into sharp focus by the decision of Uachtaráin na Éireann, Michael D. Higgins, to decline an invitation to accompany the late British monarch, Queen Elizabeth, in marking a century of the imperialist division of Ireland. The mainstream media was aghast with outrage and fury, but the President was unmoved. So too were the Irish public, who overwhelmingly supported his decision not to attend. When the story broke, Higgins was on a state visit to Rome to meet with Pope Francis. However, it was the image of the President, head bowed at the grave of the Italian revolutionary theorist Antonio Gramsci, that spoke quietly to the cascading political and economic crises of our time. Writing from his cell in 1930, Gramsci famously observed that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. In this interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear. Gramsci was, of course, reflecting on the Wall Street crisis and the subsequent Great Depression, which gave birth to a variety of morbid forces in Europe at that time. Reflecting on Brexit Britain here today, it's hard not to see similar morbid symptoms, as COVID-19 has revealed the cruel, unequal legacy of Tory austerity, economy permanently on the brink of crisis, and as Brexit continues to resurrect reactionary English nationalist forces, the asymmetric dynastic union creaks further under growing constitutional pressures. As Gramsci observed, in these revolutionary moments, each crisis of the old capitalist order doesn't merely threaten the dominant economic model alone, but the very institutions that govern society and politics also. Surveying the symptoms of the decaying system, there is no doubt then that such a pervasive sense of crisis hangs over the British political system today. Young people in particular have been burdened with the wreckage of the political and economic order. Increasingly, they recognise that they have nothing to gain from the continuation of the status quo,
looking into the future, they see only secular stagnation and the looming climate catastrophe. The Union has always contained within itself three consciously non-English nations whose tectonic plates have long been drifting away from Westminster's central control. But there is unmistakable signs now that the traditional institutions of liberal British democracy are increasingly struggling to withstand the centrifugal forces eroding the economic and political bases of the state. Whilst England continues to vote for the Tories, rejecting the path of centrist social democratic European values, Scotland, Wales and the north of Ireland do not. And in the devolved regions, a political consensus is emerging, a strengthening desire to repatriate sovereignty away from the Tories at Westminster. It's a process of transformation determined to build societies that are radically fairer, more equal and more democratic. In 21st century Britain, it now seems inevitable that Brexit, amongst a variety of these morbid symptoms, will be the catalyst for unprecedented constitutional change. Such change is now a foregone conclusion. Only the how and the when remain mysteries of the future. In the north of Ireland, the political balance of power has been ebbing slowly but surely away from political unionism in recent years. First, the unionist majority at local councils was lost. Then the seemingly permanent unionist majority of Stormont disappeared, followed next by the loss of a unionist majority of MPs elected to Westminster, and finally in May, the arrival, although delayed for now, of a Sinn Féin First Minister. You can point to the DUP's disastrous handling of Brexit, involvement in a variety of scandals, and the success of Sinn Féin in capturing the Northern Nationalist Bloc, but the simple fact of the matter is that demographic tectonic plates of the North are shifting, as demonstrated most powerfully by the census results published this week. As expected, those who identify as coming from a Catholic background now outnumber those from a Protestant community. A development that the architects of the Orange State a century ago feared intensely as they built their Protestant parliament and Protestant state. Brexit, of course, has been a powerful accelerant in the arguments regarding Irish unity and identity in recent years, as a sizable chunk of the civic, liberal, unionist bloc has broken away from the political parties of unionism, and again the census has illustrated a dramatic rise in Irish identity with a correlating fall in British and Northern Irish identity in recent years. Just as the arrival of the welfare state nurtured the rise of the aspiring Catholic middle class to challenge the Orange State in the 1960s, it would appear that their children and grandchildren, nurtured in the confidence of the Good Friday Agreement and mobilised in the wake of Brexit, look set to finally test the permanence of partition. There are, however, vital lessons to learn from the partition of Ireland for the Republican left today. A century ago, the Republican movement limited its aspirations for freedom. Despite the mass participation and public support for the revolution, its leadership were not revolutionary because their class interests were not sufficiently antagonistic to capitalism. Quite simply, they wanted to be free from British rule, but not from capitalism. Consequently, the outcome of the revolutionary period in Ireland was not political and economic freedom with sovereignty vested in the people, but a compromise with imperialism, flag independence only. Partition subverted democracy and national self-determination, and it also helped to forestall the social revolution that was espoused by Connolly, by Mallows, by Pat O'Donnell and many others. During the Tan War, Ireland had been a site of considerable radical potential by an upsurge in industrial militancy, trade union membership and rural agitation. At that time, more than 100 Soviets were established in the country. But partition set in train a counter-revolutionary state-building process north and south that circumscribed the potential for class politics. In the north, the unionist one-party regime set about establishing the Orange State through a combination of sectarian discrimination, patronage, and the political repression of those they considered disloyal: Catholics, Nationalists, Republicans, and Socialists. In the South, conservative nationalism was quickly backed by the church, the press, big business, and the big farmers. The counter-revolution, which lasted well into the 1930s, created an economic and political system underpinned by Catholic social teaching, dominated by a comprador capital class, and finally independent, subject to a neo-colonial relationship with Britain. Almost every progressive aspiration of the revolutionary period fell victim to the parallel processes of reactionary state building to the benefit of an indigenous business class and international capital. So 100 years later, as mainstream Ireland mobilises behind the civic liberal case for a reunified Ireland at the heart of the EU and tied forever to American capital, how do we instead build a sovereign, independent Irish Republic? We need to draw the forces of republicanism and socialism closer together, not merely towards a left campaign against the partition of our country, but for the social transformation and fulfilment of national liberation in the face of struggle yet to come. We need to develop a much better understanding of the nature of the state, the deep roots of imperialism, and the lasting effects of colonialism in Ireland. What power will the people of Ireland have in a new united Ireland? Currently, we're dominated by three separate but interconnected imperialist interests: the EU, the USA through the domination of American transnational corporations, and the continued role of British imperialism. The Irish political establishment has continued to hand over our political and economic sovereignty to the EU because it is in their interest to do so. They are but the gatekeepers for capital in Ireland. The people have been burdened by a massive socialised corporate debt, a debt not of their making, but one for which they are paying a heavy price and will continue to pay for many decades to come. This debt burden is a weapon being used in dismantling public services and imposing cuts in wages and working conditions, with a record number of people in precarious work, thousands of young people immigrating every single month. The debt is being used to restructure the economy in order to meet the needs of foreign capital. Education reform, health reform, labour market reform, social welfare reforms, housing, and a wave of privatisation, all in the interest of foreign capital. As our young people have left in their thousands in recent years, our rural communities have been devastated. Our towns and villages are emptying of the voices of our young and energetic youth. We can see and feel all around us the emptiness and sense of hopelessness among our families and our rural communities. We must now mobilise the people so that they become conscious agents of change, throwing off the two failed states that have so impoverished the people, who instead serve the interests of the rich and the powerful and their imperialist allies. We must set ourselves the task of breaking the grip of imperialism in Ireland and instead establish a free, socially just, democratic society, democratic in every sphere of life, a republic of the people, for the people. We need to break away from the reformist path towards a united Ireland that seeks merely to establish an all-Ireland government, delivering material improvements while building the blocks of a new constitutional settlement, piece by piece. We must avoid transition of convergence rather than a co-transformation of economic structures across the island. As the rotten nature of partition becomes more apparent by the day, there is no doubt that the forces of continuity are organising to secure their economic class interests. Absent from the equation at the moment is a transformative social, economic and ecological vision for the future backed by a mass grassroots movement. We must nurture a new politics around the interests of those who have the greatest incentive to transform the economic order. This needs to represent a breakaway from the austerity of moderation. It should be radical, insurgent, and it should be a positive vision of the future. As has been the case with the Right to Water campaign and the Emerging Cost of Living Coalition, left unity must be grounded in practical cooperation and the nurturing of effective alliances. In taking this forward in the years ahead, political education, not merely in political economy, but organisation, mobilisation and effective agitation, will be vitally important in building a movement that can sustain the immense challenges that lie ahead. Central to this is a recognition that parliamentary politics is but one side of struggle, and electoralism is a disease stitched through the very fabric of the Irish left. We need to nurture the growth of grassroots actors outside the confines of parliamentary politics in order to effectively challenge the material power of capital outside political institutions. It is vital then to invest time, energy and resources in rebuilding the trade union movement, community groups, and those rural organisations in order to realise the transformative potential of struggles at the point of production and social reproduction. If we can deliver upon these tasks, then it is the construction of forces outside of the state, coupled with an effective political strategy, that will provide the basis for a genuinely transformative grassroots movement. Perhaps most importantly, however, we have to decide what type of republic meets our class interests and our needs. What do traditional republican principles of liberty, freedom, sovereignty, equality, solidarity and secularism mean for ordinary people in Ireland today? We must remember the prophetic words of Lazare Hoche, a leading general of the French Republican Army, a contemporary of Wolfe Tone, when he warned Tone that you cannot make the Republic loved by carrying only sword and flame. We must build a transformative movement around the long-established right of the people of Ireland to the ownership of Ireland and the unfettered control of Irish destiny. A republic of equals where our laws are made by reason, not landlord, kings, nor priests. To develop the kind of freedom we want means we will have to control capital and wealth in Ireland and not allow it to control us. Our national resources should be not in the hands of private property or corporations or individuals. They should be the commonwealth of society. Oil, gas, minerals, agriculture, forestry, land, rivers and sea, all our natural resources harnessed for the common good. In the words of our great James Connolly, there is but one ideal, Ireland ruled and owned by the people, sovereign and independent from the centre to the sea, and flying its own flag outward over all the oceans. Our demands most modest, we only want the earth. Gáire míle maith.
That, comrades, was Trademark Belfast. Thanks so much for listening in. We'll see you soon, either in the trenches or on the victory parade. Up the workers and Sláinte go Fóill.